Hello, and welcome to Audio Notes. I'm your host, Nikki Sweat, and on this session, we'll speak about the final main stage concert of this season, Chamber Music Now. The performance takes place on Saturday, August 5th, and it features music by living composers, five different works, all written in the last 25 years, including two brand new pieces co-commissioned by Music at Menlo. The program begins with the duo for violin and cello by American composer and violinist Jessie Montgomery. She wrote her duo in 2015 to play with a good friend of hers, the cellist Adrian Rich. Recently, Montgomery added subtitles to the three movements of the piece. The first, Antics. The second, In Confidence. And the third is Serious Fun. I spoke with the violinist Bella Hristova about how these three descriptions play out in the music and about what she's looking forward to in performing this piece.
I love playing violin and cello duos. As a string player myself, the piano is my favorite instrument, so all I want is to feel like a complete instrument, like I can make the harmonies that a piano can make. By combining a violin and cello, composers get this huge range of a palette and sound, and they can really create rich harmonies and textures just with two instruments. So as a violinist, you blend your sound with a lower string instrument and you just create this beautiful wash of sound. On the other hand, because there's only two of us, it can be exposed. Usually the writing is very virtuosic and demanding, but I love playing with Nick, and I'm really looking forward to bringing this to life with him. She gives us a lot of interesting things to do. There are a lot of pizzicatos. There's some glissandi with the pizzicato, so it creates a cool texture. That's a little easier to do on the cello because you have a longer string length. I want to read something that she wrote about it. It says, "It's an ode to friendship that is meant to be fun and whimsical, representing a range of shared experiences with friends." I can also totally see the unfolding of a friendship and the people conversing. The second movement reminds me of a chorale. It's something very private, I suppose, and intimate, and the pulse makes it feel more solemn. Later in the movement, you have big outbursts in the cello. With the violin holding a drone, and then the violin repeats that, but sort of almost as a memory, kind of reminiscing. And then the movement ends as it began. But to me, that sounds even blurrier. So kind of like another memory.
And in the last movement, it's serious fun. What does that mean? What's serious about it? What's fun about it?
I interpret it as seriously fun because there she really uses the whole range of both instruments. So each one finishes the other's gestures. It's like a circle, or there are a lot of waves. So the violin starts and the cello continues the line, and vice versa. It's a race to the end. It's a very high energy movement. But those waves make it really, really enjoyable.
The Chinese-born American composer Wang Ji has written a new piece for piano, violin, cello, flute, clarinet, and narrator for Menlo's concert season, which deals with the topic of isolation as it was experienced during the COVID-19 pandemic. I had a wonderful, wide-ranging conversation with her while she was in the middle of her writing process. We talked about her philosophies as a composer, her thoughts on this instrumentation, and she gave me just a few hints about the piece that will be heard on this concert.
You have this composerly mantra of engage, explore, play. And I was quite excited by that. Can you tell me about each of those imperatives and how they find their way into your music?
I'm not trying to sound smart here, okay? And my math teacher would hate me. Engage is about audience engagement. 90% of music making happens on stage. The other half comes from the audience. Okay, so maybe I can't do math, but that's what it is for me. When I'm being creative, I'm always holding the audience and the musicians and people who make music, who engage music, in my mental space. No matter how beautiful the music making, it's only beautiful when the people, the audiences, perceive it as beautiful. This thing that we carry around that hosts our soul and all of our history and story and memory, this body is in the concert hall, is being vibrated by the music and the composer. We have this sacred calling and mission. We come up with these alchemy of feelings through notes. When they reach the audience, it actually vibrates every cell in their body. That's engage. Explore comes from a story I heard from Malcolm Gladwell and his TED Talk. You know, the TED Talk was so popular, it's impossible not to know the chunky tomato sauce story. The chunky tomato sauce would be the final winner of that whole multi-million dollar market research. But the moral of the story is that, one, people didn't know they would like chunky tomato sauce so much. And so many of the people, 30% or something, which is significant market, you know, would fall in love with chunky tomato sauce, which didn't exist before. So what came to mind is Rite of Spring, right? I mean, first, you know, there was so much resistance to the piece, but then now it's like such an essential part of classical music repertoire. The other thing is that at the end of the day, it's still a tomato sauce. The innovative flavor, they had 20 something different flavors, okay? All these cutting edge, innovative, they have their place and they occupy the shelves. But at the end, it's really telling that how a tomato sauce, at the end of the day, it's just a different form. It's like there is one aspect of the tomato sauce that's been altered. And then people have so much engagement with this exploration process. The spirit of explore is that I want to take my audiences on a journey. Of course, you know, it's an adventure and the audiences are giving me their time and is taking a chance in hearing a work that they've never heard before. So I want to take them on a journey. I also know that that journey has to be rooted on something that they feel secure in. And for me, that is the authenticity of Western classical music. And the other is that I believe in empowering the musicians to lead the audience into these previously unexplored aspects in the music.
The instrumentation of this newly commissioned work, violin, cello, piano, clarinet, flute, and voice, is the same as that used by Arnold Schoenberg in his groundbreaking, shocking 1912 melodrama Pierrot Lunaire. I asked Wang Ji if her piece was at all inspired by Schoenberg's example.
I've heard a live performance of Pierrot Lunaire in my undergrad. This is like 20-something years ago. My entire musical world just blown open. I feel like the time between these events have been milestones in my musical consciousness. It's so obvious that music just erases the markers of time. Years has gone by, and it was like the first time I heard Pierrot Lunaire alive when I had the idea for this piece. So it was like a no-brainer. I just had to propose this instrumentation. I'm at a really mysterious place with this piece and I'm enjoying the process of just staying with the mystery of what this ensemble really wants to be. And also think about the ensemble, right? There are two woodwind, there are two strings, and then there's the piano. It's a very versatile, and for me, it's a very delicious instrument to write for. The ensemble itself is an instrument.
You did mention it's a funny piece. Could you say something about that, the ways in which humor or perhaps play are finding their way into this work, as far as you can tell?
I think this comes out of a pandemic experience where the only way to really look at this experience is to rise out of it and to experience the joy of life and all the playful things that life offers. This is a very lengthy collective trauma, this whole pandemic. People have all kinds of creative ways to cope with isolation. And the isolation could be physical isolation, it could be a spiritual isolation, it could be all isolation takes on many forms. And it just speaks to the tenaciousness of creativity that's innate in an individual who the protagonist of our piece, he is coping in his way, coping with the death of his friend. And maybe there's a small part of me when I lost my friends, and actually I lost my father during the pandemic. I had many, many reactions that I couldn't really put to words. But then when it came out of me as words, I was being funny. I was being surrealistic. I wanted to embody a different kind of spirit. My desire is to be able to share some of the things that I have experienced and being able to put in my artwork to share with the audience.
Themes of isolation and resilience are also to be found in Seven Signals for piano, violin, cello, and clarinet, written in 2019 by the Australian composer Brett Dean. The piece is described as dealing with the power of nonverbal communication in a time in which verbal communication seemingly leads us to constant misunderstandings. Music itself is, of course, a powerful tool of nonverbal communication, but here Dean is equally interested in other forms of embodied visual and sonic signaling, which express things with a clarity and urgency that words can't always muster. The fourth movement, for example, is based on the pas de deux ballet dance, where two partners intertwine and carry out variations on a fixed motion. This work is dedicated to the choreographer Jiri Kilian, and it's in this fourth movement, this middle movement more than any other, where we can imagine dance as a powerful form of nonverbal meaning making. Translates several different visual signaling systems into audio formats. For example, in the penultimate movement, we're hit over the head with insistent strokes of a fixed pitch played four times in a row. These are scratches on a prison wall, tallying the days that have gone by and communicating to a cell's next occupant some of the obsession and the frustration of imprisonment. The second and the fifth movements are likewise concerned with visual modes of representation. The fifth, full of pointy gestures and occasional brash atonality, is titled Semaphore. This is a system of communicating by way of waving flags. The movement is more about the physical motions that the players make to execute their signals than the actual sounds they produce. It's a policy that culminates in the music that closes the movement, where the string players swish their bows through the air in a visual dialogue. And in the second of the seven movements, we hear a sounding imagining of the role that a beacon of light plays in guiding ships through a fog. Flickers in and out as it makes its solemn rotation. The first, third, and seventh movements frame this collection of signals with a more or less coherent narrative. The opening of the piece establishes pulsing as a general means of communicating without linguistic assistance. Then, in the third movement, pulsation is used by the musicians to express a message in Morse code, one of the most familiar nonverbal signaling systems. This message is the SOS call that was sent out by the radio operator of the RMS Titanic as it sank into the North Atlantic Ocean in 1912. As the movement builds to a climax, we hear CDQ, a general distress call, and SOS repeated over and over again in Morse code. This Morse code message also forms a grumbling foundation for the final movement, where it's tapped out in the low register of the piano. The other instruments form a glassy texture above, eventually moving to a ghostly presentation of a hymn, Nearer My God to Thee, which is supposedly what the Titanic's orchestra played as the ship went down. It's a haunting conclusion which speaks to how music can capture terrifying, tragic circumstances and the ways we try to communicate in those circumstances in a manner that words can't quite approach. This concert is also going to feature the world premiere of a brand new piano trio by the American composer David Serkin Ludwig, which was co-commissioned by Music at Menlo. Since they're married, I spoke with him together with Bella Hristova, who will also play in the premiere performance of this trio, and I asked him about writing for this instrumentation and also what it's like to work on new music together.
I know you've written a few trios before in the last few years. What are some of your favorite piano trios in the repertoire that you look to when you're writing for this instrumentation?
I'm drawn to all the great piano trios from the past, maybe starting at Beethoven, Schubert, and then certainly in the 20th century, some extraordinary piano trios, and not just for violin and cello and piano. I think about contrasts and other pieces. You know, the piano is like a kind of mini orchestra there, but really in a way, if you're thinking about it orchestrally, it's like a concerto for three instruments together. Ultimately, though, it has so many possibilities and can take so many different forms that I'm very compelled by it, by the form of the piano trio, by violin, cello, and piano. And this will be my fourth, so that's proof of what I'm talking about. I'm always interested in telling stories and sharing messages and ideas. So ultimately, the medium is what changes, but my messages, what I'm sharing remains the same because it comes from me, regardless if it's a string quartet or an oratorio. On the other hand, there are some unique opportunities you have in writing for a piano trio. All music ultimately is this intersection of the horizontal or melodic and vertical or harmonies. And so the piano trio gives us kind of an opportunity to hear both of those in the way a piano can give a real fullness and resonance vertically in its harmonies, but also the melodic potential of the string instruments. And then it gets very interesting when you shift back and forth and give harmonies to the string instruments and melodies to the piano.
Do you have the sounds of performers you know will be playing a work in your ears when you're thinking about what to write? Or is that something that comes in later in the process and you try not to allow to interfere with what you're doing?
I absolutely have the sound of the performers, even the specific performers, in my ears as I'm writing. And that's kind of the trick I've always felt in composing, that you want to write something that fits the performers you're writing for like a glove. but that that glove can then fit other people too, and so that they can make the piece your own. So it's a kind of balance moving back and forth between addressing maybe what you hear in particular in the playing of the person you're writing for, but allowing a flexibility in the interpretation that someone else could pick up the piece and do something perhaps different and just as creative and musical.
Do you workshop things together during a sort of compositional process, Bella, when you're going to be performing the premiere or even when you know you're going to be playing?
People can't see her smiling right now.
I like to stay out of the way because I don't want to influence David's compositional process through any reaction I might have, conscious or unconscious, or whether I think something might be awkward to play or not. So I try to stay out of the way. If David has specific questions about a technique or something like that, I will get involved. But usually I like for him to finish his process and then we might go through the part and see how it feels. So I do like to stay kind of removed from it.
You know, I have to say I have the incredible privilege to live with someone who's one of the greatest musicians that I've known or will know. And so for me as a composer, having someone that I can play a little bit of music for and get a kind of immediate reaction just off the cuff is incredibly valuable. And so sometimes I call Bella my editor-in-chief.
I love to edit the scores. After he's finished, when we're proofreading, I go in with a red pen.
Sometimes I'll sit and play something and sing something else and stomp my feet and all the sounds are happening in my head. I don't know
how happens in his head. And he's like, and this is happening here and that's happening there. And I have no idea what he's talking about.
And yet somehow you're able to give me very good feedback. You say, oh, you know, that could repeat one more time, or please don't repeat that one more time.
Right. It's more of an instinct thing than something that I think through.
The short of it is, I think we're a good team.
In 1994, Chinese-born American composer Tan Dun wrote a work for string quartet, various found percussion instruments like stones and water, and also for the pipa, a plucked Chinese traditional instrument that's often compared to the lute. It was called Ghost Opera, and the composer described it as a reflection on human spirituality, which is too often buried in the bombardment of urban culture and the rapid advances of technology. He also described it as a cross-temporal, cross-cultural, and cross-media dialogue that touches on the past, present, future, and the eternal. How does the composer achieve such a dialogue? Well, some of it comes from the interactions between the pipa and the string quartet. What you're hearing is actually Tan Dun's Concerto for Pipa and String Quartet, which he created out of parts of the Ghost Opera in 1998. In the first movement of this concerto, the quartet forms a tutti section, brimming with violent energy, which starts off with the slides of the cello. It builds with scratches and shimmers from the whole band. When the pipa finally comes in, it adds a strummed verticality and also harmonic depth. At the same time, it feels like a soloist entry from many a classical or romantic concerto. But very quickly, the pipa diverts the chaotic rhythms of the strings, moving the whole ensemble to a much more contemplative plane. Soon, the strings start learning from the pipa, dedicating themselves to imitations of the instrument's strummed texture. The second movement, like the first, begins with a cumulative add an instrument format, but this time the soloist kicks things off. The violin eventually enters on figures filled with glissandos and an infectious rhythmic drive. But again, as in the first movement, the energy dissipates into something more open and spacious, a striking gestural pipa cadenza. At the end of that cadenza, in quite an astonishing passage, the pipa strums open fifths, and the string quartet surprisingly tune their open strings, beautifully clearing the air before Tan Dun turns to another strategy for bridging different eras and cultures. In his third movement, Tan Dun uses two different primary melodies. The first is introduced by the violin, accompanied by the pipa, where we hear strains of the Chinese folk tune Little Cabbage. The lower strings introduce us to a quotation, very richly orchestrated, from J.S. Bach's Prelude in C-sharp minor from the Well-Tempered Clavier. He finds many different ways to weld these two musical ideas together, and the movement builds to quite a special place, becoming a highly expressive statement on the alignments and points of departure in music with quite different origins. Tan Dun releases some of this emotional tension in the final movement with more virtuosic and fun writing. It's quite a bit more dissonant than the music that we've heard before in the piece, but at this point we really do trust the composer to find ways to bring these dissonances into the fold with music from past and present. He chooses to end the finale calmly and quietly, as with all of the other movements, letting this particular moment of communion between different musical worlds dissipate into the atmosphere. Audio Notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Bella Hristova, David Serkin Ludwig, and Wang Ji for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Two of the recordings featured on this session came from Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center performances. Jesse Montgomery's duo for violin and cello was played by Benjamin Beilman and Nicholas Kanalakis. Brett Dean's Seven Signals for clarinet, violin, cello, and piano was performed by Tommaso Longquich, clarinet, Arno Sussman, violin, Nicholas Kanalakis, cello, and Wu Chen, piano. Tan Dunn's Concerto for Pipa and String Quartet was performed by the chamber players of the Greenwich Symphony. The artists were Minxiao Fen on pipa, Christoph Witek on violin, Susan Hitken Metcalf on violin, David Creswell on viola, and Daniel Miller on cello. Audio Notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.